This is Bootstrap Web, episode 57. This is the podcast for you if you're the founder who learns by doing as you bootstrap your business online. Today, we're going to talk about some listener questions and comments. Things like, is $99 the new $19? I think it is. I sure hope it is. So we'll get into that. And we'll talk about a few other comments, questions. We love these episodes. We love talking about real things that you guys are dealing with. So if you want to hear your issue and question, just let us know. As always, I'm Jordan.
And I'm Brian. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. And we've got a couple of really good questions to answer here. And as always, you know, you can always reach out to us on Twitter, at Jordan Gal or at CastJam, and send us your questions, or you could always, you know, submit them on the form on the website as well, bootstrappedweb.com/ask. And, you know, just tell us what you're working on. What are you up to right now? And if you want some feedback, if you want us to kind of talk a little bit about it on the air, you can let us take a look. So today, let's get right into some updates. Jordan, what are you up to right now?
So for the most part, no, not much has changed over the past week, except for my focus, and I've really just been thinking about math a lot. So as exciting as that sounds, what it really means is just looking at a spreadsheet of projections and trying to figure out what needs to happen over the next few months and over the next year to make this thing work for me. So how much do I need to spend? How much needs to come back in order for that to work? And you know, as you're staring at a spreadsheet, you know, a lot, you start to learn about the key metrics and the drivers, the things that make the biggest difference. You know, like when I change average revenue per user, that makes a huge difference. For me, yeah. Right now, at this stage, I really look at how many customers can I acquire per month. That's really the big driver at this stage.
You know, I've actually found the same exact thing, and we'll definitely talk about this more when we get to that question. On the $99 or $19. I was, you know, playing around with the similar spreadsheet for my business a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, that average revenue per user makes such an impact on the bottom line, like across the board. And I have in the past have always been kind of focused on the number of users number as like the key metric, like how many new customers we're adding every month. And then I kind of shifted to total monthly revenue for the month. And now I'm kind of focused on that average revenue per user. So,
which makes sense, interesting. Right? Given the stage that you're at, you know, if you have a lot of users, then increasing the amount that each pays by 10% is a big deal. But if you're right, I'm in acquisition mode. I just want new customers because the fixed expenses in the business, the salary, the hosting, all these things that are fixed, they need to be overcome by revenue. And that's just adding more people won't really increase those expenses. And so just the more people that come in the door, the closer I get to profitability because that starts to cover these fixed expenses and beyond. And you know, the other piece of this whole thing is when you look at a spreadsheet like this, it makes you act more and think more like a business owner instead of an operator. And so looking at month to month, looking at right, let's say for example, your business spends $20,000 a month and you're currently bringing in $5,000 a month. Okay, so losing $15,000 a month, that looks like a disaster if you look at it for month one to month two. But if you grow at the right rate over the next 12 months, you might lose $15,000 this month and then $12,000 next and then $8,000 after that. And then at some point it tips over. And so that view of things, looking at a 12-month picture instead of a 1 or 2 month picture, it changes your thinking. It changes the question from are you making money right now to would you pay this much money over the next 12 months in order to have an asset that makes this amount per month, right? If someone said, do you want to take over this business that loses 15 grand a month? That sounds terrible. But if someone says, Jordan, would you pay $100,000 right now for a business that 1 year from today will make $25,000 a month? And I think most people would say yes to that question and no to the first question. So yeah, so it just helps change your thinking into something more strategic, right? And then I can dive back into the day-to-day work, but at least I have this this perspective by looking at the math.
You're cutting out a little bit, but you know, I always kind of like look at those numbers in like the same way, and you know, for me, at least currently, I'm in this mode of, you know, spending a bunch of money on different channels to kind of get some data and see what's working, and then I can, you know, have a better picture of what these projections are going to be. Like last month, I was making all these big projections for the year of 2015, and now I'm starting to, you know, throw a bunch of these new strategies at the wall to see what's working. And I'm actually in this mode now where I was making some assumptions that I can, you know, easily get this many clicks and this many leads and opt-ins, and certain things are turning out to be a little bit more difficult than they are, you know, like certain given assumptions. So it makes it difficult as you look at these like hypothetical projections and looking ahead. But at the same time, you know, what I'm kind of learning, and I've been learning for a while, is that you have to, you know, put in a couple of weeks of just trying a bunch of stuff to get, you're basically paying for data to get a more accurate view on that spreadsheet. And then that makes things easier, just like what we've been talking about in the last two episodes. Like right now, I just hired a new customer support person, and next up I'll be hiring that developer. So trying to get people in the door so that work can get done, so that I can focus more on this marketing stuff. So I think we're in the same boat there.
Yep, you got to do it. What else do you have you have going on? Yeah, is that the conference coming up? What, next week?
Yeah, so Big Snow Tiny Conf. Let's see, when this airs, I'll be on the road the following week. You know, we're going January 26th, and man, I'm so excited for this. This is going to be awesome. We've got 12 people signed up. We're renting a house at Sugarbush, Vermont, just a mile or two from the slope, and been organizing. This is the second year in a row organizing it with Brad Tunar. Of course, this year is sold out. Every bed in the house is taken now, but if you are interested in getting in, we will almost certainly do this again next year, this time next year. So you can go to bigsnowtinyconf.com and get on the mailing list, and you'll hear about it, you know, about a half a year from now when we start organizing the next one. I'm just really excited about this. It's going to be like, you know, half day snowboarding, half day hanging out and talking business, kind of like a mastermind group and meeting some new faces and whatnot. So, should be a lot of fun. What else? So I've been reading Nathan Barry's recent post and about how he handles his email autoresponder, or how he recently changed it. And I've heard this concept from different people in different ways before. And I never really wanted to implement it for myself, but now I am thinking about doing it. And basically the idea is, setting up an autoresponder that goes out to all new subscribers who just joined your list, and have it like cycle through a whole bunch of your previous articles from your archives. And that way, you know, your older articles that may have come out like a year ago or even like 2 years ago, which might have resonated big time at the time, you know, they're not getting buried in the archives and never to be seen again. All of those new subscribers who may have just found you today, they can still get them. So I guess the idea is, and I've just been trying to wrap my head around how this would work, because I want to make sure that when I do come out with new articles, which I try to do every 2 weeks or so, I want to make sure that my list is going to get it. I want everybody on my list to find out about my stuff. But I also need to embrace the fact that like not everyone needs to get my latest article at the very same time. And so I guess the whole idea here is, you know, new subscribers, they'd be on a sequence of, it might even be like three to 4 months of weekly articles being sent to them. And these are articles and newsletters that I've written before. They're getting those over a sequence of like 3 to 4 months. And then at the end of that, now they're just dumped into like the general newsletter list. And that's who would get like the broadcast emails of, you know, if I'm going to publish a new article tomorrow, I'm going to send a broadcast email just to the people who've been on the list for a while, but the new people are still getting the older articles. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. The concept of the newsletter happening in real time is just this embedded relic from, you know, from when email marketing started 10 years ago. But the truth is the ideal is the never-ending autoresponder. Right? Someone joins your list and then you choose to give them the absolute your best stuff in a particular sequence. And not only does that theoretically maximize your impact on them and have the benefit of potentially maximizing your revenue from stuff that you're selling, it also gives them your best stuff. Instead of them missing out on that just because it happened 6 months ago, they actually get the biggest impact. So, yeah, we know several people that do this. Yeah, the way I've seen it before from someone like Andre Chaperon, the autoresponder guy, it's a never-ending autoresponder, but then people can raise their hand at any time if they are interested in something that you're offering in real time and then get onto that sequence, but everyone else isn't disturbed. Everyone else just keeps getting good value. So, I think this is one of those benefits of writing great content over a long period of time. These things are assets, and you can use them instead of just saying, okay, everyone who joins today only gets the good stuff from today going forward. It doesn't make as much sense.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there are a couple other benefits there. I mean, you can, when a new subscriber finds you and subscribes to your email list, that's like their warmest period. They're not going to be more excited about your stuff than like those first 2 to 3 weeks that they just joined your stuff, because they just found you. They've been reading, you know, maybe going through the past couple of weeks of your articles. So they're really excited about the stuff. So that's when you want to kind of send them your very best stuff and keep that going, you know, as much as you can, and really solidify them as like a loyal subscriber. And then the other piece of this is it adds a little bit of freedom to you as the blogger, because, you know, it keeps that treadmill turning, and you can go through a period or two and not be able to, you know, put out a new article, but rest assured that those new subscribers are still getting the, you know, some really quality content.
Yeah. And Nathan's post on it is interesting in that, right, this is sort of the logic behind Drip. Right, so when I jumped on to Drip as a customer, you have to wrap your mind around a different, it's like a different theory. Like, there's a difference between MailChimp and sending out emails in real time to a large group of people, and this other concept of campaigns that happen based on when the person entered that campaign. And that could be an opt-in, that could be becoming a customer, starting a free trial, and then just having the broadcasts that go out all at once to everyone as part of it, but not the main component to your email marketing.
Yeah. I mean, I use Drip, quite a bit now, and I still use it in somewhat of like the old school way. Like, I love using Drip for all the automated courses, and we've got some like marketing emails that go out on Restaurant Engine and all that sequence kind of stuff set up. But we still, both on Restaurant Engine and on my personal newsletter, I still do the weekly or weekly-ish broadcast newsletter, you know, the same thing goes out to the whole list. And I mean, like, maybe it is time to get away from that, but you know, there is one downside to this whole approach of putting everyone on this really long autoresponder. And I guess that's sometimes you do want to have like a real-time announcement, like tucked in along with your newsletter. Right. And I've done that quite a bit. You know, like around the time I was launching Productize last year, I would just send a newsletter with like my latest article. And by the way, you know, just a reminder, this thing is launching next month or something like that. Or, you know, what I did last year was I'm headed to MicroConf next month. Are any of you on my list going to be there? You know, maybe we can meet up. Those kind of little notes and PS statements probably can't get out to those new subscribers who are currently going through the automated sequence, but
unless you inject something in real time along with it, right? They're not necessarily mutually exclusive.
I think that would have to be a separate,
right? You could,
but that would have to be a separate broadcast. Like,
yeah, okay. So yeah. You know, every few weeks that someone gets two emails a week instead of one. Yeah, Cool.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, and then like the other quick thing here that I've just been thinking about, like speaking of writing and sending to the newsletter and blogging, like I've been working on this new article for the last like two weeks now, and I've been trying to get it out and published before I go away to Vermont. And it's just one of those things where I'm writing and writing. It's up to like 3,000 words now, and I'm just like, you know what? This is not there. I'm just going to trash the whole thing. And this happens from time to time. I've done it a number of times, but now it's like, I'm just really, I feel like my writing has come a long way, but at the same time, I'm like self-critical in that I'm too long-winded in these posts, you know, 3,000 words. I want to get it down to like 1,000 or less. I prefer the more focused, you know, tighter point being made, and I want to try to get to that. And I know that what it takes is more practice writing them on a more frequent basis, which I just don't have the time for right now. So, but you know, I had this 3,000 word post that I've been working on, and I knew what I wanted to say, but then I just kept writing. I kept like, I had this topic, and then I'm like, oh, but I've got to tell them about this. I got to teach them about that. I got to make sure that I mention this. And then I flesh out this whole thing, and it's like, this is like, nobody wants to read this long, you know?
That's tough to scrap it at that point, but if that's the gut feeling, that's what you gotta do.
Yeah, I mean it's tough, but then it's like I felt such a relief afterward, you know, because now I'm gonna go back and rewrite it from scratch, and I know exactly what I'm gonna focus on, and a whole bunch of stuff that I'm just not even gonna touch, and that'll make it a tighter post, I hope. So we'll see about that. But anyway, that's the update. Let's head right into the questions for today. What do you think?
Yeah, what's first? We got something from Craig Hewitt on Twitter. Right, and he says, let's take a look. You talked last episode about finding those first customers. How about strategies for doing that in service businesses? I'm assuming, right, as opposed to software product businesses, getting those first customers with a service business. I don't know if they're that different from one another. It was a bit different of an approach, but you have any thoughts on it? Brian, in general, I know you've done the service, the agency, the productized service thing in the past. What's your take?
Yeah, I think today, if I were starting to offer services, and I mean, I do offer services in different ways, like through Restaurant Engine, and even like when I do some like coaching stuff through Productize, but I would probably do it differently today than I did, you know, a couple of years ago, or, you know, when I was doing freelance web design consulting work. I mean, the common way to do it, the way that most freelancers do it, is they go out to like job boards and they respond to a bunch of leads, or they rely on referral leads and whatnot. The way that I would do it today is I would go ahead and build like a productized service, or come up with some kind of productized offer, you know, a set price, set scope, and just really focus on coming up with a clear problem and solution, a value proposition. And of course, there are different ways that you can do that. And you can go back to a previous episode where we talked all about that. But then I would figure out who my ideal client is, and I would make a list of about 50 of them, you know, maybe go through my LinkedIn contacts, or just people that I know, or people that I've seen around the industry that I'm trying to target. Then I would, if I'm like brand new at this and this is a totally new offer, what I would do is I would try to do it for free, offer it to do it for free for one or maybe two people. These might be people that I know personally, or I would actually go to that list and maybe cold email 10 of them and try to get one or two to agree to me performing this service for them. And the goal there is, of course, to get feedback and to adjust the service and make sure that it's working. And I mean, because there are always going to be unforeseen, you know, kinks and hiccups, or, you know, different pieces of value that you thought was valuable, but really the client cares about this and not that. So you're going to learn about all that stuff. And then, of course, at the end of the day, you're looking to get a really valuable case study from these clients, and then you can use that to sell paying clients on the service. And then from there, I would go ahead and cold email 50 of those handpicked prospects, you know, personalized emails one by one, and just send them your pitch, your idea, connect with something that they've been working on. And then you might even go a step further and actually create like a personalized video, you know, talking to them, or maybe like doing like a website teardown, depends what the service is. You know, saying like, hey, you know, I've been really like what you're doing, but I've created this personalized email for you. Here are a couple of tips that I think could really help you. And, you know, I would love to talk to you and schedule a time where we can talk about this further and see about working together.
Yeah, I think that's a smart approach, right? I think the key in this question is the first customers. So we're not talking about a service business that is stable and now wants more customers. That's a different thing. If we're talking about getting the first few customers for a service business, then I think the most important thing is to make sure that what you want to offer, people actually want. So the difficult thing in that is that you need to find out who would need it most, right? If you want, right, I came across a good productized service recently from a buddy here in Portland, Josh, that offers to set up your analytics. Right, so that's definitely valuable. But who do you want to offer that to at first? Not everyone. You want to figure out who's going to find that the most valuable. So if it's new sites that are just coming online for new companies, and they're saying to themselves, I need to get everything set up in analytics is something important, then right, he should be going after those people to figure out, is this a viable business? And if so, who's going to get the most value out of it? So if you're in that stage, I think that's what you want to do. The first goal is just figuring out, is this viable and who makes it viable? Who finds it the most valuable? From there, I thought you had a lot of good ideas. I think working with people in your network, either for free or for a reduced rate, just gives you so much feedback and so much confidence in figuring out where the value is, how to talk about it, how to describe it. And then the really important part to come out of that with is to be able to talk about what you've done for someone else. So if you work with a buddy or a friend of a friend or someone you've kind of know one way or another, and you can just say, you know what, I'll set up your analytics and I'll do X, Y, and Z for you. And if you're happy about it, then, you know, can I use you as a reference? So if you want to do this for people for, I don't know, $1,000, then you can find someone in your network and say, are you willing to pay $100 for this just to see if there's value there? Do it for them, do it really well, and then you can walk away from that saying, hey, I just set up Cardhook's analytics and this is the result of that. Over the past month, this is what they're learning from it. Is this something that sounds interesting to you? You're in a similar situation. Then you have, you know, right, you're like parlaying one thing into the next, into the next, into the next.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so let's move on to the next one. This one comes from Patricia Carvalho. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. She says, I was wondering if you'd consider talking about business journaling talking about business journaling on one of your future episodes. I really liked the one that you talked about goals and how you measure them. I was really curious to know more about business journaling. So I actually replied to Patricia's email a couple of weeks ago, but I'll talk more about it here. Again, you know, I use an app called Day One. It's, you know, really easy to use on iOS, iPad, computer, syncs across all of them. It has like a little lock, like passcodes that like only you can get into it every time you open it. You know, so it's like super private if you really care about that kind of thing. So I don't like use the journal or write in the journal on a regular basis, like every Friday or every night or every morning. I know a lot of people do that. I don't get into that kind of routine with it. I just kind of write in it when I feel that I need to get some things out of my head and written and think through something. So that happens when I have a lot of things on my mind and I need to sort through different plans and different options. Everything that I write in there is very, very list-based. I'm a big bullet list person, as I know a lot of people are. So I also mentioned, I think, in the previous episode about how what I write in there usually doesn't make a lot of sense to anyone else but me. And sometimes even to myself, when I read back a couple months later, it's like, what does that even mean? I don't know what that even says. Is that a word? You know? Because it's, I know that I'm the only person who's ever going to read it. So I never hit the backspace. I never delete. I never edit. I just write, and I don't care if things are misspelled or doesn't make sense. Maybe I should care more about that. Examples of things that I would write in there. Sometimes I was actually writing in it last night at 1 a.m. when I should be sleeping so I can wake up early. But, I just had a ton on my mind thinking about these plans of the sales funnel and the things that I need to change, you know, going into the next couple of weeks. And so I needed to play out different scenarios. Like, if scenario A, what does that entail? And then how does that going to play out in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months? And scenario B, what does that look like? Like, who are the people that will need to come in for that? You know, just kind of going through that stuff. Or sometimes I'm like really wrestling with a super hard decision. You know, should I do A or should I do B? And what are the pros and cons of that? So I'll make two lists for that. Lastly, the thing that I've found it to be really helpful is when just something's not right and I had a really bad couple of months, you know, or just really struggling with something, I'll write about that and I'm going to write about, I'll try to like diagnose it. I'll kind of troubleshoot it in a way and, you know, write it down. Like what's really getting me down personally, or what's not working in the business right now, and figure out what are the factors that have caused this. And just writing it down is not going to solve those problems, right? You know, you're going to have to get out of that hole somehow, and that, you know, that eventually will happen. But what this does really help with is that it kind of prevents this thing from happening a second time or happening again. Because having written it down and having this whole documented of what happened, just really helps. So I could look back on it, you know, 6 months, 12 months down the road and be like, wow, I've really come a long way since that low point. And I don't even have to reread it. It's just like, there's just the act of writing it, and getting it out of my head kind of like solidifies it as like, okay, I'm acknowledging this happened, this went wrong, this is why. All right, we're moving on.
Yeah,
so that's how it helps.
That's what I see the real benefit being. It's not that you go back and read it. It's that writing it forces you to think about it and work through it, find the words to put to it. That's what I would see as the benefit. I don't do any of this. I just instead think about, you know, business all day, every day, and while I sleep, which I don't think is the healthiest approach to it. So I can see the value in this, and I assume by journaling, she this is what she's talking about. A regular written contribution, looking back, learning, putting it into words. I think it's a good idea. I personally just find it very unlikely that I will do this personally. I just don't have the discipline for it, or, you know, I can make the excuse too easily that I don't have the time for it. Yeah, so I think I'd do it in my own way, but I don't do something like this. It would be interesting to try. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around how or where or when I would actually get it done. It's one of the pitfalls of working on your own.
I can totally relate to that.
You know, in other businesses, you work with other people. You know, every Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally relate to that. Like, I can't really even fit it into my
kind of its own form of looking back and I haven't. Like, I don't. What's going on?
We're cutting out again.
No, go for it.
Hey, Jordan. Hey. Okay. So you can hear me?
Yeah. So we took a little break there. I guess we'll cut that out later. It's a good 2 minutes of just of silence. But I think we're good.
Okay. I think that covers that question, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I see how we can help. I don't do it. I'm happy to try to be persuaded by it. I think it's healthy, but I guess everyone does it in their own way.
Yep.
How about the next question from Dennis? This is a reader from your newsletter.
Yeah. So Dennis replied a couple. This was maybe a week or two ago, and he said, you know, because one of the questions I asked there is, you know, what's your biggest challenge and that you see over the next 12 months? And he says, you know, I spent the last 10 years working at different startups, and I never really had the experience to try building something of my own and charging for it. However, I would also put as a huge challenge is my fear of putting my work out there. I admit that I get constant nagging feelings of, oh, that idea will never work, or how will you ever expect people to pay for that? So it's a struggle to get those in check sometimes. And, you know, I could really relate to this. I know that a lot of people out there can, for sure. I always come back to this idea. I heard someone say it recently. I forgot where I heard it, but just this idea of practice in public, right? Like, you've got to put stuff out there and understand that everything that you do is a practice for your next attempt. You know, I still feel that way today with Restaurant Engine. I very much look at Restaurant Engine like a huge learning experiment that I'm going to take all these lessons from and apply to whatever next business I come up with, you know? And that's how I felt about the businesses that I did before this, when I was selling WordPress themes or when I was doing freelance web design work. You know, everything is, you know, like, nobody ever gets it right on their first try, and you're going to get a ton of things wrong on your fifth try too, you know? So you've got to just keep on learning. You've got to embrace that. And that should make you, like, understanding that fact that you have to make mistakes in order to learn, that should make you eager to jump in and do that thing and get it out there.
Right. It's not going to get any better. Like, when if you're more well-known, that's even more pressure to perform. And it's even scarier to do things in public and look bad or be afraid of what you put out there. The truth is, when you're anonymous, you know, then that's actually the time to just go for it. What do you have? No one's watching anyway. Nobody cares about what you're doing for a long time. So, yeah.
That's exactly right.
That's the time to just go for it. What's the worst that happens? You go back and delete some blog posts, or, you know, this happens all the time, man. I was just talking over email to Joanna Weeb. You know, copy hackers, these guys are well known. These guys are really good at what they do. And they launched a software product, and they just shut it down. You know, it's just, and that's in public with a big audience, with a big reader base. And then you have to say, you know what, this isn't working, and we're going to shut down the business. And that's a failure, and I'm just going to keep moving forward. That's a lot more stressful than when you're anonymous. It's much easier before people know you to just, I mean, the truth is, all these feelings are totally understandable, and we all deal with them. But the bottom line is that the market does not give a shit about your feelings, and there's no pity out there. And it's not me trying to be harsh. It's just the reality. Nobody cares. And so the way I look at it is, if your desire to succeed is strong enough, then that will overwhelm your fears and your issues and your struggles. Like, right now, not a goddamn thing in the world is going to stop me from succeeding, and people looking bad or laughing or whatever, like, that is nothing compared to succeeding for my wife and my daughters. Like, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's our job. That's what we're here to do, is to go out and do things and put things out there. And, you know, I've always come back to this idea of, I'm like deathly afraid of regret. I can't stand it when I think back on something and I regret something. And it happens all the time, by the way. I mean, I could look at, like, yesterday and think of, like, three things, like, I shouldn't have said that stupid ass thing, you know, or
that's a good mindset.
I could look at, like, last year or the year before. I mean, all you need to do is look into the archives of my blog, and there are plenty of huge announcements that I thought were going to be the next big thing that turned out to be, you know, major missteps on my part. I didn't delete those posts. They're there. But, you know, I'm always so afraid of regret, and I know how much it kind of burns to think, like, oh, that was a stupid thing, or I shouldn't have done that. But the worst kind of regret, I think, is to look back a year or look back 10 years ago and think, oh man, if I had only had the guts to launch that thing, I wonder what it could have been like. You know, that's, I never want to get to that point. So I just want to throw out a bunch of things and hopefully something will come together that I won't regret. The other piece of this that I, you know, you mentioned in this question here, I spent the first 10 years working at different startups. And this tells me that, you know, maybe you're working alongside a few folks who are pretty accomplished and achieving a lot of big things, like your coworkers and the people that you're working with there. I don't know if this is like a personal thing on my part, but like I would try to remove what you're doing away from them and just remove the thing that you're going to launch, like launch it in public, but don't necessarily launch it to your circle of people that you see every day. Does that make sense? Like you should definitely try to extract any kind of like help and guidance and experience that you gain from working at those startups, which I think is awesome. But I tend to try to launch stuff in public, but kind of like launch it to strangers.
I think that's great advice.
That's how I push myself to do it. And same goes for me. The same goes for like family and friends. Like so many of my family and friends really have no idea what I do for a living. I never publish any of my stuff on Facebook. I mean, I'm not totally secret about it. When people ask me about it, I'll talk about what I do, but I really don't like talking about what I do to people who aren't like us. You know, like I only like talking to people like listening to this podcast and going to MicroComp.
Right, in our world. I think it's great advice because the feelings of, oh, it won't work, or how can I expect people to pay for it? I might be wrong on this, but a lot of those feelings come out of a place of worrying about what our peers think of us. Right? Yeah. Other people like us. The truth is you should be much more worried about the people who might pay you. Like if you release an app, you should not care at all about what your competitors think or what your friends or other people in the industry think about how ugly the design is and how it's not a smart idea, or if you're thinking small because you're building software for contractors and that's boring and it's not consumer. Like that doesn't matter. The people who might pay for it are really where you should be focused. And as long as they like it, I don't know. It's like focusing on the wrong thing. So I think that's great advice to kind of look at it as it's separate. You don't have to be super public, especially if it's like small, that something you're launching, no one's even going to know about it at first. So you don't have to go. Yep. You don't have to go talk about it and worry about what people will think for a lot longer than you think.
Yep.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a good question. Right, it's relevant, but you know, no easy answer there.
Yep. All right. Should we get on to this final question here? And this is one that I actually grabbed from the forum over at discuss.bootstrapped.fm. That's a great forum. A lot of good discussions happening there. I try to hop in there from time to time. So this one kind of popped out at me today, and we'll include the link to that forum thread. It's a public forum. Anyone can join it. So we'll include that link in the show notes, but it's a very simple question. It says, is $99 the new $19? And he was asking about SaaS pricing models. And, you know, because I think, and it's true, if we just look at all these new SaaS products that are being, you know, launched and put out there, I think, yeah, like a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, everything was in like the $19, the $29 range, or even like $9 range. You know,
the assumption,
just crazy
right,
low.
The assumption was thousands and thousands of users. You know, and
yeah, you look at like a Dropbox. You know, you look at like Dropbox, or you look at you know any of these
Evernote,
small
right things that are widespread. I mean, Skype. You know, Skype's $3 a month for like to be able to call from Skype. That's because they're going after 50 million customers, not what we're dealing with.
Yeah. Sometimes I wish Skype would just charge me more money so that they can give me better service. But
yeah,
that's another story.
Yeah, that is another story. But I love this. Is 99 the new 19? I think it's very relevant. I know when I struggled through how to price CartHook, I tried to be as humble as possible, not in the pricing, but in the potential to acquire customers. And that's it. And this is the advice I give to people who ask about this. It's to get 100 customers is not easy. And so if you're going to do the work to get 100 customers in the door, it's probably not that different if you can ask them to pay $40 a month or $100 a month. So I always looked at it that way. It's if you price it for cheap, it's just really hard to make the math work of acquiring customers. And it's something that Jason Cohen talked about in that talk that I brought up last week, and I see you want to bring it up in here. You watched it last night, so it's fresh. I want to hear your take on it.
I did watch it last night, and I mean, I've been reading his blog for years, so it was a great kind of like recap of a lot of different ideas that he's been writing in the Smart Bear blog, in that talk from 2013 at MicroConf. I mean, yeah, it's just so awesome the way that he put it, just running the math, like getting to 10,000, monthly recurring revenue. It's so much easier when you're in that 99 to 250 a month range. And this gets back to our discussion earlier, talking about that average revenue per customer. Again, this is another big point that Jason brings up in that talk. It really makes such an impact, and you can literally see it when you run the numbers in a spreadsheet. Just increasing that average monthly revenue from by like $10 or $20 makes a huge difference. But of course, if you make the jump from like $19 up to $99, that's a major shift. A few things that I think you need to get your head around, and I've had to go through this process myself. Like when I first launched Restaurant Engine and Hotel Propeller, I looked at $49 a month for the main service. Like, man, who is going to pay this? That's pretty high, because when I look at like other web hosting providers, they're charging like $6 a month. And if I look at how you can go about getting a WordPress theme installed and set up, I mean, that's practically free. It's like, who's going to pay for this? And then sure enough, customers find value in it. And now that I'm learning the impact of average revenue per customer, I've just recently added, a new tier on Restaurant Engine, which brings it up to $99 a month. So now there's a $49 and a $99, and that helps. We have a couple of new customers on this higher plan. And I've done the same thing on Hotel Propeller, again, to raise that monthly cost. I mean, that monthly revenue. You do have to look at it like you have to add something of value, and you have to make sure that the value is there. But the realization that I had to come to, and this is very difficult, or was for me, was that like I need to get out of this mindset of like, would I pay for that? Like, am I this type of customer? And at the end of the day, I'm not the customer. I'm just running this business. I'm not the target customer for it. For me, like restaurant owners find a ton of value in having all this stuff just done for them so that they don't have to pay for it. And they're willing to pay $100 or more per month to just have it handled. Whereas I'd be happy to just have my assistant do it or I do it myself for the same type of service.
Right. The pricing conversation and the pricing level. Yeah, looking at it from your own point of view, definitely not ideal, right? It's always price based on value and all that, but it's tricky because you have to look at the competitive landscape if it's that type of industry. It's not an easy question to answer, but I don't think I would enter a business that you had to charge very little money for. $19 a month, something in that range. If you think about, you want to get to something substantial, $50,000 a month. At $99 a month each, it's 500 customers. Like that's a lot, but that's doable. You can do that. If you take that and multiply it many times over, $20 a month for 50,000, that's 2,500 customers. That is just a very different thing. You can't spend money on acquisition. You have to depend on different types of traffic, it just sounds a lot riskier to me. So if I were going into a business and I didn't see how it justified, I didn't see how it provided enough value to charge at least $100 a month, then I don't think I would do it.
Yeah, that's right. It comes back to that question of like, all right, there are plenty of business models out there. You look at Dropbox, they're, you know, they make plenty of money, but that's a different business model. And for us who are, you know, bootstrapping something from the ground up, self-funding it, with our own savings or with a credit card or something, you know, you've got to look at what's most viable for your current situation. And when you start running that math, finding fewer customers paying more per customer just makes sense. Of course, you know, that the extreme of that would just be consulting, right? Like, doing a project for several thousand dollars. But, you know, there are middle grounds there. You could look at like a productized service, you know, a retainer type of service, which can be very valuable. Maybe just find 5 or 10 clients who can pay you, you know, $1,000 or so every month. That's a great little business right there. Or, you know, go down a couple hundred a month and offer some kind of service and find 50 to 100 customers, you know, and kind of claw your way up that way. And it's a much more viable path forward.
Yeah. And I think you see examples of it in the bootstrap world. And you find yourself envious of people who are in that situation. I remember a few years ago when I did the foundation course, right? I wanted to just kind of up my game on the software marketing and all that. I remember looking at Dane's business, and he was doing somewhere in the range of $40,000 a month at that point. And his average revenue per user was close to $200. And I said, okay, that's interesting. $200 a month for software. He's adding a lot of value and he only needs about 200 customers. I can do 200 customers by brute force, by knocking on doors and just hustling. So I kind of took that as a mental note. And then I saw his most successful student, Sam Ovens, with Snap Inspect, and I saw the same thing. I said, Snap Inspect, their average revenue per user, I think he got it to like $10,000 a month in revenue in like 6 months, which is awesome. And then I looked at the average revenue per user that he was talking about, and it was somewhere in the $150 range. I said, so that, you know, that seems to be a lot easier to make work if you find a good problem to address. And you're providing value, then you can charge more for it, and charging more for it, it makes the path to profitability and success just a lot easier. You just need, you know, you need 100, 200 clients, and you have a real business going, as opposed to, you know, much higher numbers at the lower price point.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, that's how I look at it. All right, cool, Brian. So I think these were some really interesting questions, right? The pricing issue, how to get your first customers. In a service business, journaling and looking back on what you're learning, all these internal emotions that we deal with and doubt, all these things that swirl around in our head that prevent us from doing what we're capable of doing. This is right what people in our situation deal with, and you know, I'm just appreciative that people are open enough to share it. You're definitely not alone in all these crazy struggles. Everyone deals with it. In their own flavorful way.
That's for sure. So yeah, this was a good one. We'll wrap it up here, and we'll be back next week with another Bootstrapped Web. As always, you can dig into the backlog of episodes over at bootstrappedweb.com. And if you want to get your question answered or just hear our feedback on what you're working on, bootstrappedweb.com/ask. And you can be one of the smartest people on the internet and head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and tell us what you think of the show. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. Brian, have a great weekend.
You too, sir. All right. Later.
Cheers.